Today is March the 20th, 2019. It is the first day of spring. In other words, it is the moment of which the center of the visible sun is directly above the equator. In the northern hemisphere, the equinox in March is called the vernal or spring equinox. The September equinox is called the autumnal or fall equinox. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Before we start, we offer our condolences on the deaths of the 50 people in New Zealand and touching upon the uncomfortable and problematic relationships that Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube currently have with the extremist content. The attack was live streamed on Facebook, footage from which has now been and continues to be uploaded multiple times on YouTube. The alleged attacker has now been deleted from the Twitter account, where he posted multiple photos of what appears to be machine gun magazines and a link to what is being described as a manifesto for his actions. Over the last few years, these platforms have faced a barrage of criticism for their apparent reluctance to remove extremist content, and the consequences of this are the loss of 50 lives in New Zealand. Platforms like Facebook and Twitter might claim they are not publishers, but the current moderation strategy is clearly not fit for any purpose. Our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and survivors of the attack and the people of New Zealand. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the internet as well as on various podcasting hosting sites. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM, on the internet, and PCRadioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comment to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805, and you start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. 2/3 of Android antivirus apps don't work properly. It can be wise to secure your Android phone with antivirus software, but which ones can you count on? You can rule out most of them, according to AV Comparatives, who had tested 250 antivirus apps for Google's platform, and only 80 of them passed the site's basic standards. That is, they detected more than 30% of malicious apps from 2018 and had zero false positives. Some of the apps that fell short would even flag themselves, according to the researchers. In some cases, the failure is a simple one. They're not really scanning app code. AV Comparatives found that just using app whitelist or blacklist, and sometimes very broad ones at that, they may allow all apps whose package files start with com.instagram, but it would be trivial to create rogue apps that use a variant on that name. The apps that passed mustard came from familiar security brands, with big names like AVG, Kaspersky, McAfee, and Symantec catching everything. Those that fell short had a familiar pattern. Many of them were written by amateurs, cookie-cutter apps, or from companies that clearly aren't focused on security. Anti-malware apps from 32 of the vendors in the test have vanished in just 2 months since the test took place in January. It's safe to say that this serves as a reminder to stick to antivirus tools from companies with solid track records. However, this also illustrates the challenge that Google and other store operators face in screening apps. They can verify that the apps aren't causing harm to users or violating the law, but they can't enforce a baseline level of quality needed to keep your phone safe. The source of where you can get qualified antivirus software that has passed the mustard, try AV-Comparatives. The Federal Trade Commission has just issued another warning of another round of scam phone calls claiming your Social Security number is about to be suspended because of fraudulent use. And the FTC has provided the following tips. Your Social Security number is not about to be suspended. You don't have to verify your number to anyone who calls out of the blue, and your bank accounts are not about to be seized. The Social Security Agency will never call to threaten your benefits or tell you to wire money, send cash, or put money on gift cards. Anyone who tells you to do those things is a scammer. The real Social Security number is 1-800-772-1213. But scammers are putting that number in the caller ID. And if you're worried about what the caller says, hang up and call that number, 1-800-772-1213, to speak to a real Social Security Agency agent. Even if the wait time is long, confirm with the real agent before responding to one of these calls. Never give any part of your Social Security number to anyone who contacts you, or your bank account or credit card number. If you do get such a call like this, the FTC has asked that you report it. There has been a Charter Spectrum settlement that was announced. Under a settlement that Charter Communications has made with New York State, Spectra customers on Staten Island will be able to receive free periods of premium movie channels and rebates of up to $150. The consumer fraud settlement was made with the New York State Attorney General Office in December after allegations the company was not delivering the advertised fast internet speeds. It was given 120 days to make the offer and the rebates available to customers. Spectrum is offering free a choice between 3 free months of HBO or 6 free months of Showtime. Interested customer must call Spectrum at 1-833-422-8795. That's 1-833-422-8795 by May the 31st of this year. The offer is valid only to customers in New York who have no outstanding obligation to Charter Communications and those who don't already subscribe to HBO or Showtime. The premium channels will be removed from the customer's account at the end of the promotional periods. Charter Communications is required to issue $62.5 million in refunds, which consists of $75 to each of more than 700,000 active subscribers who lease modems or Wi-Fi routers that were unable to deliver fast internet speeds, according to a release from the Attorney General Office. Customers subscribing to a Time Warner Cable Legacy speed plan of 100 megabits per second or higher are also eligible for the $75 refund. Charter is also required to give an additional $75 refund to more than 150,000 subscribers who had a modem for 24 months or longer that didn't deliver fast internet speeds. The rebates will show up in people's Spectrum bills, and customers don't have to do anything to get those rebates. Under the settlement, Charter is required to implement a series of precedent-setting marketing and business reforms, including requirements to describe internet speeds as wired and substantiate them through regular speed testing. The company also made network enhancements to improve its internet service in New York. When big tech negotiates with municipalities, they do it on their terms. And because many municipalities are anxious to have big tech associated with the city, many municipalities are quite anxious to have big tech be part of the city because they expect that there are benefits. In the recent cancellation of the agreement between New York City and Amazon, many people were lamenting that it was a lost opportunity. Maybe not. Because here's another case where another big tech company, how they dealt with another municipality. And what am I talking about? When Google Fiber abandons your city as a failed experiment, what happens? And what did happen? Google Fiber, Alphabet's gigabit broadband service, started its relationship with Louisville in 2015. After a 2-year delay, and negotiations over its rollout, the company adopted a novel but cost-effective plan to bring ultra-fast internet speeds to Kentucky's largest city. This February, only 16 months after it turned on its service, Google Fiber announced plans to turn it off, making Louisville one of only 19 cities to get Google Fiber since its launch in 2010 and the first to lose it. Google Fiber left behind disappointed consumers, unfulfilled promises of transformative economic development, and a slew of embarrassing headlines for a city that allowed the tech giant to use it as a guinea pig. But Google Fiber got something out of its time here, and it learned that nano-trenching, which is the cost-saving process of burying fiber optic cables just 2 inches underground, was a bust. Google said, "We currently do not have plans to call for 2-inch trenches. Our primary specifications are focused on going deeper." Well, why didn't they in Louisville? In October 2017, when Google Fiber started signing up customers in 3 Louisville neighborhoods, this is what happened. The plan in Louisville was called Google Fiber 2.0. But first, the city had to agree to one major stipulation. Google wanted to see if it could scale a method for installing fiber cables that was easier to implement and easier on the bottom line than hanging lines from utility poles. The company had buried fiber lines in other cities, but in Louisville it wanted to go shallower. Nano trenching called for burying cables just 2 inches underground rather than the typical 6 inches. The company also wanted to cover the trenches with epoxy rather than a typical asphalt mix. A Google Fiber spokesman said the company had already performed limited trials of 2-inch trenches in other markets, and it believed it was a promising new method of deployment. In Louisville, Google Fiber wanted to see if 2-inch trenches would work at scale. Local leaders were concerned, though, and the city sent a team to other cities where a company spokesman said limited trials with 2-inch trenches had been conducted and it sought the advice of outside experts. Google Fiber told Louisville that they didn't think that they could make their traditional construction work, but would they be open to letting them use a new construction technique? They felt confident that they could make this work. After years of trying to woo Google, an effort that including spending around $400,000 on legal fees to defend an ultimately unused city ordinance that made it easier for Google Fiber to use utility poles, Louisville was in no position to say no. It's a little surprise then that Louisville agreed to let Google futz around with its roads. The town of 600,000 is perpetually trying to catch up with the population and business growth in peer cities such as Austin, Nashville, and Raleigh, which are all Google Fiber cities. Louisville finally had a chance to join the gang of cool kids. The enthusiasm after Louisville accepted Google's fiber offers tells the story. Gigabit internet would help make Louisville a technologically innovative community, igniting a transformation that would result in a citizenry that's more skilled, engaged, and prosperous than ever before, local leaders said. Well, that didn't happen. By March of 2018, just 5 months after Google Fiber launched its nano-trenching trial, the method began to fail. Not only was the sealant spilling out onto roads, leaving fiber lines exposed, but the shallow trenches left cables vulnerable during routine road maintenance. If anyone understood road technology or tire technology, they would have known this was going to be a problem. The problem is that tires easily grab the epoxy and rip it out of the ground, and the shorter trench walls also left less asphalt for the sealant to adhere to. Typical micro-trenching, a well-accepted method of installing fiber, involves burying cables at least 6 inches deep with a groove that's no more than an inch wide. Last summer, Google Fiber pitched a solution to the problem it created. It would rip out the epoxy and fill in the trenches with asphalt. It was like, oh, in retrospect, that seems like an obvious way to fill the hole in the road. Then, last month, Google Fiber threw up its hand and quit. The company wouldn't say how many customers had it at that point, only that the numbers was, well, what they said was small compared to other fiber cities. Google Fiber explained what happened. In their trial, a different type of construction method, In Louisville, it had failed, and fixing it would have been too expensive, so instead it was skipping town and taking lessons learned elsewhere. Wait a minute. You mean they start on a project, didn't work to their liking, and they leave the city empty-handed? This was not an easy decision for them, a Google Fiber spokesman said in a statement. He also said, "We came to Louisville because Google Fiber is working to change an entrenched industry, and we saw a chance to bring great service to Louisville residents. Naturally, there will be unexpected challenges when you do something ambitious and at scale for the first time, and we underestimated some of those hurdles. We couldn't be more appreciative of the partnership we've had with the city of Louisville, which embraced the need for competition in this industry as part of its larger initiatives around innovation and emerging technology." Google Fiber was very sincere in their belief that they could make it work and had planned to use 2-inch trenches in all other Google Fiber cities if it did work. That's little consolation to those living in Louisville, who watch one of the world's richest companies sweep into town with major fanfare, rip up the roads to test an unproven technique, and skedaddle out of town when it bombed out. Now that spring is here with the warmer months ahead of us, millions of Americans will be planning their summer getaways. To help us stay connected, you will probably most likely look for accommodations that have free Wi-Fi. HighSpeedInternet.com has created a report revealing the hotel chains with their Wi-Fi plans. The present database includes many popular destinations worldwide. Business travelers depend on the internet to stay connected to clients, remain in contact with the office, and to conduct meetings on the go. Recreational guests want fast Wi-Fi for entertainment purposes and for keeping in touch with family and friends. Unfortunately, many hotels who boast about free Wi-Fi neglect to ensure that the quality of the connection is worth the price they charge for the stay. The availability of Wi-Fi has become a major factor when it comes to how many people choose their accommodation. But selecting a hotel for their Wi-Fi is useless when the service is spotty and the bandwidth is limited. No one wants to deal with constant buffering and slow speeds that limit browsing and downloading. HotelWiFiTest.com is a free-to-use service that has a massive database of speed tests and other characteristics of the hotel's network. It is an excellent way to alert you about problems with the service they offer. You can also, during your next hotel stay, visit HotelWiFiTest.com to take the test and add to the database to share with others who may be contemplating a stay at the accommodations. The installed base of Windows 7 installations worldwide is about 11-12%. Windows 7 end-of-life nag messages will start showing up next month. Microsoft promises that you'll be able to turn them off. As the end of Windows 7 free extended support period nears, Microsoft is going to do more to tell Windows 7 users that their operating system will soon cease receiving security updates. Starting next month, which is April, the operating system will show users a courtesy reminder to tell them that security updates will cease and that Windows 10 and the hardware to run it exist. Microsoft promises that the message will only appear a handful of times during 2019 and that there will be a Do Not Notify Me Again checkbox that will definitely suppress any future messages. For those organizations that intended to keep using Windows 7 beyond its January 14, 2020 cutoff date, Microsoft has up to 3 years of paid fixes through its new extended security update scheme. These will be available to any organization with a volume license and will have a ratcheting cost structure that doubles the price each year. So it's time to start looking for a new machine to replace your existing laptop or desktop unit. Well, what with graduation and Father's Day and Mother's Day, we're also talking about Windows 7 being phased out. Many people will be looking to buy a new system. Benjamin Rockwell has a 3-part series which he has prepared about buying a system, and the first part would be choosing a desktop versus a laptop. And this will be followed by choosing a monitor setup and choosing a laser printer.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm going to relate to you how some of the work technology bridges the gap into personal technologies. This week, I'm actually going to be discussing how an IT professional chooses if you get a laptop or a desktop. Now, you can apply this same information towards your own decisions at home, your own personal decisions, or maybe you're in a small office kind of situation. Now, for starters, there's the easy one, the executive directive. Frequently, this is a decision that's made by someone who isn't even in IT, and they're just making a financial decision. Or maybe they're selecting, okay, Joe is salaried and John is not. We're going to give Joe, yes, he's going to get a laptop and John's going to get a desktop. We may be choosing based off of who is able to work for the company from home. Or maybe there's some other arbitrary factor that's known only to the higher-ups. And I've seen this in a number of different directions. But when it's in the hands of IT, then we start looking at a number of different things. There's the obvious portability issues. Being able to bring the laptop along with you is a great option. And if you have many meetings, even if they're on-site meetings, it becomes far easier to work with a laptop. Some open environment offices have realized, too, that being able to retreat into one of many small conference rooms when you're under pressure is actually a great option, and a laptop wins in this situation. Now, there's also the possibility of breakage. Because a laptop is portable, there is that possibility for theft, actually losing it, or yes, breakage. And a laptop is vulnerable to all sorts of abuse that a desktop is never going to see. Now, the common thought is that at the same price as a comparable PC, the expected life expectancy of the laptop for usage is 3/4 of the time of a desktop. Each of these items is a contributing factor, but businesses increasingly accept this as almost a tie, as that portability issue far outweighs the breakage issue. Now, there's the overall computing power needs, and that is where we start really dialing this in. If you're a CAD user, if you're doing video or photo editing, if you're a specialty user, many of these different items require higher power and sometimes include specialty ordering needs that are not common with your standard laptop purchase. So we're talking about beefed up hard drives, we're talking about beefed up CPU or memory. And this is where the desktop will actually start to win for those specialty users. That desktop situation is going to be far cheaper than outfitting a laptop. I've seen laptops that were $15,000 compared to a $6,000 desktop. So yeah, this kind of starts to change everything as far as the power versus price. Now, the low-end purchases also kind of reflect something. If the company that you're working for is purchasing very cheap systems, then when we start matching the CPU, memory, and hard drive size, then the price point of a desktop is far better than a comparably equipped laptop. Now, companies shouldn't run like this. Companies should not be choosing based on pricing alone, but it is a reality. For here, desktop wins. Screen real estate. Younger users may get an option for a laptop sooner than older employees, as the screen size starts to become important for those with older eyes. We can hook up an external monitor, and we can hook up dual screens for when one is in the office, but it requires a docking station, which adds a price as well. So for the older folks, we might choose a desktop. We're going to give them a choice. We're going to have them see what the screens look like to help make that decision. Then we start getting into those quick fix and quick replacement issues. Computers need repair frequently. We wouldn't have IT departments as large as they are if we did not need to repair them. So, desktop computers allow for IT departments to standardize and fast swap various systems or even just components when an outage occurs. If your desktop has a problem with the main system, if I planned properly, I can have you up and running in 30 minutes to an hour with your basic needs. I'm going to have you set up frequently. It's a permanent fix. Now, if you use a laptop, that might stretch out to a day or two before you're up and running. So we've got a number of different things that get in the way here. Broken screens. That's a total bummer. And I have to make a decision to stock the exact same make and model of your laptop to move the hard drive over in case you have a broken screen. And moving that hard drive over from the old laptop to the new laptop might be far harder. I remember pulling apart a laptop once. I had to remove the back, remove the front, remove the keyboard, and there's this weird little ribbon cable, and I had to get that just perfectly right. And then I had access to the hard drive. That was roughly 90 minutes to pull it all the way apart and put it all back together. And that was just a simple hard drive replacement. What if that wasn't the problem? Replacement components are also frequently non-standard. They are special order. So there's that repairability. Desktop components are all replaceable when they go bad. I can replace the power supply, the keyboard, the monitor, the mouse, the hard drive, all of these in a matter of 10 to 15 minutes. I can keep a small amount of parts in stock, ready to go, and have you running in no time with less expense to the company. Most technicians actually start off repairing desktops. That means that laptop repair is more of a specialty. It requires more of a mechanical mind, one that can work with the nuances. So desktop really wins in that situation. And yet there is no right answer, but that gives you a glimpse of what I have to work with when deciding between the two options of you getting a desktop or you getting a laptop. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. And we look forward to next week on your next segment on choosing a monitor setup. Okay, so you bought some new equipment, and what do you do with the old stuff that you want to get rid of? How much personal data do people leave on their used equipment? A recent experiment by Josh Frantz, a senior security consultant at Rapid7, suggests that users are taking few, if any, steps at all to protect their private information before releasing their used devices back into the wild. For around 6 months, he collected used desktop, hard disk, cell phones, and more from pawn shops near his home in Wisconsin. It turned out they contain a wealth of private data belonging to their former owners. Frantz amassed a respectable stockpile of refurbished, donated, and used hardware, consisting of 41 desktops and laptops, 27 pieces of removable media, that is to say memory cards and flash drives, 11 hard disk drives, and 6 cell phones. The total cost of the experiment from a total of 31 businesses, and he bought whatever he could get his hands on for a grand total of around $600. Frantz used a Python-based optical character recognition tool to scan for social security numbers, dates of birth, credit card information, and other sensitive data. The pile of junk turned out to contain, get this, 41 social security numbers, 50 dates of births, 611 email accounts, 19 credit card numbers, 2 passport numbers, and 6 driver's license numbers. Additionally, more than 200,000 images were contained on the devices, and over 3,400 documents was also contained on the devices. He extracted nearly 150,000 emails. Only 2 of the devices were erased properly, and only 3 were encrypted. I had, in a previous broadcast, suggested that a quick way of erasing the data, because it takes a long time, is just encrypt the disk as if it was ransomware. A similar study at the University of Hertfordshire recently found that more than 2/3 of the used USB drives sold in the US and United Kingdom still contained the data of their previous owners. Out of 100 drives purchased in the United States, 64 had data that was deleted but could easily be recovered. There are a lot of tools available to help users properly sanitize a hard disk. Franz recommends using DBAN, also known as Direct Boot and Nuke. But in the end, if your device was host to some very sensitive data, why chance it? Some suggestions goes like this. Use a hammer, incinerated, industrial shredding, use a drill press, acid, electrolysis, microwave, thermite. Gee, doesn't all this sound familiar with the recent news about 30,000 emails? All of these methods require the use of proper safety gear and some requiring training. Never stick a hard drive in your microwave or try to melt it in your oven. If you don't have a large area clear of all flammable materials, you should not be burning anything, ever. The inside of your home is not an appropriate place to try and destroy your computer. If you wish to do a good deed and donate your technology so others can benefit, make sure it's at least wiped to an acceptable standard. Encrypt it, as I suggest. Even if a company claims they'll erase your data for you, there's no good way to know whether that's actually true unless you perform the wipe yourself. Do a little research before you cut the cord. You're probably expecting some separation anxiety after years of cable TV bills. Earlier this year, Comcast announced their 2019 price hikes on a long list of plans. Some triple play packages will cost as much as $215 per month after your promotional offer ends. The cheapest triple play package will now cost at least $155 a month after your promotional price ends. Let's not forget the fees and the taxes that will be added on top of that price. And the price does not even include the new hikes on fees and device rentals. How do you determine which free over-the-air TV channels you can tune in? Make a list of all programs you want to keep. Before you cut the cord, research and test a couple of them before settling on which ones you want. Choosing a streaming TV service is really hard. Signing up for cable is relatively easy. There are generally one or two providers with distinct pricing packages to choose from, and picking one simply depends on, well, price and channels. That's not the case with live TV streaming packages. Channel offerings are all over the place, and you need to make a list of the ones you can and cannot live without. Your bill can go down. Streaming is more expensive than cable if you subscribe to every service you now have on cable. But the beauty of cord cutting is that you only pay for what you really want and use each month. If there's one thing you don't have to worry about with cable, it's the capability of the remote. Don't be surprised if you need to subscribe to more than one single streaming service to get all the channels you want. You will find switching from one service to another adds an extra step of navigation in the learning process of your remote. The streaming service all have excellent guides with large previews, channel icons, and great navigation. Channels, however, will take a little longer to find when you switch from channel to channel. The guide might be good for finding random shows, but it's not so great for tuning into a specific channel. The order and arrangement of the channels in your current cable bundle are grouped with food shows as one genre together and kid networks grouped together as a genre also put together separately. Streaming services such as DirecTV Now, on the other hand, boils networks down to simple alphabetical listings, putting greater emphasis on favorites and bookmarks. Under the Comcast guide, channels are logically grouped, local stations were near the top, and you could easily type in a number to jump to a channel. Now, with streaming, CBS may come after Cartoon Network. An alphabetical listing seems like a smarter option in theory, but you may prefer having a group listing. The speed and picture quality varies greatly between platforms with streaming services. Some streams will not play high definition. Others constantly pause, and on some devices, you may not be able to receive certain channels. So depending on the source you're using to stream, the experience will vary all over the lot, even if They're all hooked up to the same television. You'll find Nickelodeon to be hard to find. With kids in the family, it's pretty much a must-have. Since Nickelodeon doesn't have its own pay service, and its content is locked behind a provider paywall, so if you have kid or kids who watches any of the Nick channels, this may be a major reason why you want to continue with the present service. Streaming services offer a cloud storage option that lets you record live TV and fast-forward through commercials. However, it's nowhere near as fast as easy to navigate. With cable services, you could all watch different shows in different rooms, provided you have separate set-top boxes hooked up to each TV. Live TV streaming gives you more control. It can remember the last show you were watching on any device, so you can flip on the game in another room without missing any of the action. The major trade-off when you are considering cord-cutting is, well, it's cost. Personal computing and the colorblind. According to the Prevent Blindness America, an estimated 8% of males and less than 1% of females have color vision problems. Red-green color deficiency is the most common form of color blindness. A person may inherit a trait that reduces the ability to see blue and yellow hues. What is color blindness? Most of us share a common color vision sensory experience. Some people, however, have a color vision deficiency, which means their perception of colors is different from what most of us see. The most severe form of these deficiencies are referred to as color blindness. People with color blindness aren't aware of differences among colors that are obvious to the rest of us. People who don't have the more severe type of color blindness may not even be aware of their condition unless they're tested in a clinic or laboratory. Inherited color blindness is caused by abnormal photopigments. These color-detecting molecules are located in cone-shaped cells within the retina, called cone cells. In humans, several genes are needed for the body to make photopigments, and defects in these genes can lead to color blindness. There are three main kinds of color blindness based on photopigment defects in the three different kinds of cones that respond to blue, green, and red light. Red-green color blindness is the most common, followed by blue-yellow color blindness. A complete absence of color vision is total color blindness is rare. Sometimes color blindness can be caused by physical or chemical damage to the eye, the optic nerve, or parts of the brain that process color information. Color vision can also decline with age, most often because of cataract, a clouding and yellowing of the eye's lens. Men are much more likely to be colorblind than women because the genes responsible for the most common inherited color blindness are on the X chromosome. Males only have one X chromosome, while females have two X chromosomes. In females, a functional gene on only one of the X chromosome is enough to compensate for the loss on the other. This kind of inheritance pattern is called X-linked and primarily affects males. Inherited color blindness can be present at birth, begin in childhood, or not appear until the adult years. The most common types of color blindness are inherited. They are the results of defects in the genes that contains the instruction for making the photopigments found in cones. Some defects alter the photopigment sensitivity to color, for example, and it might be slightly more sensitive to deeper red and less sensitive to green. Other defects can result in total loss of a photopigment. Depending on the type of defect and the cone that is affected, problems can arise with red, green, or blue color vision. Red-green color blindness. The most common types of hereditary color blindness are due to the loss or limited function of red cone, known as protan, or green cone, Dutran, photopigments. This kind of color blindness is commonly referred to as red-green color blindness. Blue-yellow color blindness is rarer than red-green color blindness. Blue cone, tritan, photopigments are either missing or have limited function. Then there is complete colorblindness. People with complete colorblindness, otherwise known as monochromacy, don't experience color at all, and the clearness of their vision may also be affected. Thankfully, Windows 10 is there to help you out with a mode intended to help you discern color differences a bit better. Go to Settings, Ease of Access, Color and High Contrast, toggle Apply Filter On, and after the toggle is turned on, you can turn the color filter on and off using the keyboard shortcut Windows key plus Control plus C. To quickly activate or deactivate the mode, there's a keyboard shortcut to turn on and off colorblind mode. You can always use the Windows key plus Control plus C to turn on and off your current filter. Sounds a little complicated, but it's not. What you do is just go into the help mode and just say Windows 10 colorblind mode on and off, and you'll get the details on it. Today marks the vernal equinox, the spring event when the Earth's equator bisects the sun at its center, so the center of the visible sun is directly above the equator. Day and night are equal, each 12 hours. It's the beginning of spring, and Marty Winston has some thoughts about what that means for your house. Before you spring it on us, Marty, how are you doing on that 40-year maintenance-free igloo that you're working on?
It's nice to think that if Cole Porter had been an astronomer, the song to be sung twice a year might have been Night and Day, You're 1 to 1, which would be the ratio of daylight hours, minutes, and seconds, to nighttime hours, minutes, and seconds, each exactly 12 hours, but only twice a year. Night and day come out even, precisely the same length, exactly 12 hours each, only twice a year. Those 2 days, when it happens, those 2 days go by the name equinox. Equa meaning equal, and Nox having been the name of the Roman goddess of the night, then itself having come to mean night, equal night, twice a year. Once as we shift from winter to spring, called the vernal equinox, which refers to the greening up that happens, the other happens when summer turns into fall, and it's called the autumnal equinox. For astronomy geeks, these are the 2 times a year that the sun crosses the celestial equator. And to be more precise, it's the plane of the ecliptic, meaning the orbital routes of the planets, that's doing the crossing. None of which has much to do with your energy bill, except that it brings our attention to night and day. So, in this segment, I'm going to talk about how night and day considerations can favorably influence how you approach lighting, HVAC, safety, fresh air, and a few other things. If you check around hardware or home improvement stores, you may see outlets with integrated white LED lights. Look more closely and you'll see that many of those products also have photo sensors, so those white LEDs only come on when their surroundings are dark. Some also have passive infrared motion sensors, so they only come on when they see somebody moving in the dark. If you replace one or more of your low-on-the-wall outlet pairs with one of these, you gain some minimal lighting that can help prevent tripping or stubbed toes in the dark, and they should last for decades. Seasonal dawn and dusk time shifts mean you may be driving to work with the sun up for part of the year, but in the dark for the rest of the year, or driving home in daylight some of the year and in the dark the rest of the year. One way or another, you don't want to be in the dark between the house and the car. Especially when, surprise, you're not alone in the dark and the company is unwelcome. You can replace or sometimes modify outdoor lights to come on only when there's motion and only in the dark. If you want, you can also add a timer so they won't come on during hours when what they see is a dog or one of the false alarms that some people think of as a ghost. An HVAC doesn't really respond to light and darkness, at least not directly. But it does respond to the sun warming things up when it isn't nighttime, and not warming things up when it is nighttime. I'll guess that your house is insulated, but that the insulation is less than ideal. That's true for most people most of the time. So, what's the best way to knock around once the vernal equinox is knocked at your door? More warm time in the summer means more open door time and more open window time. These can be good things, as my wife phrases it, because they're blowing the stink out of the house. And on that subject, forced fresh air exchangers are a technology you may want to look up and look into. I talk about sealing the envelope of the house to stop energy losses, but that also locks in stale air. Forced fresh air exchangers are special-purpose blower boxes, usually mounted in an attic, and they create a deliberate but limited outside air path year-round. That makes the air less stale, not just less stinky, but with somewhat less carbon dioxide and somewhat more oxygen than if everything was always shut in. That's kind of what you accomplish with open windows or open doors when the weather outside is so nice that it's what you want your indoor temperature and humidity to be. Now, note those factors, because once the outdoor starts getting too warm or too humid, it's time to close those doors and windows. One more thing, also on the heels of the vernal equinox, is pollen. And for that matter, with the snow no longer covering the ground, dust. Anybody at your house have allergies? You might have to do with a little less fresh air time than your neighbors enjoy. In a few weeks, I'll tell you about one way that technology can make that a little less of an issue and cut down on your dusting and vacuuming while we're at it. But for right now, when's the last time you cleaned the HVAC filters? If you checked not so long ago and now they seem to suddenly need that cleaning, dust and pollen can help explain that. It isn't just the filters. Your HVAC has an outside unit that can itself get clogged up with dust and pollen and seeds. Get your hose out there and let it breathe. Remember, things that don't breathe or have a much harder time breathing are more likely to stop working. And that's not just about people. It's a good time to wipe down your dehumidifier and make sure it still works. Can you remember what it is that makes the flowers in May come your way? Yes, April showers are just ahead. And some of them may not wait for April. Humidity can tend a lot higher right now and in the months ahead. A little attention to your dehumidifier now can make that, well, no sweat. Next time, my segment will come on the very last day in my life when I'll be 70 years old. And we can think about how houses getting older impact people and how people getting older impact houses.
Thank you, Marty. Hey, Marty, I was only kidding you about the igloo. I know it was a regular house. Public service announcements. TCF is this Saturday, March the 23rd, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. TCF is a one-day festival held at the College of New Jersey campus in Ewing Township, New Jersey, covering computing and electronic technology. The keynote speaker this year is Tony Sega, who is from the Center for Internet Security, and the topic of his talk is Never Say Anything, the Education of a Cyber Geek. He worked for the NSA for 34 years, so he has quite a bit of experience to tell you. The feature speaker is Rebecca Mercury of Notable Software, and she will give a presentation on a 2020 vision of the U.S. election security. At the festival, there's also an indoor vendor fair and flea market of 50-plus talks, workshops, tutorials, demos, and special events. The highlight of some of these events are Object-Oriented Programming University, with one day of short courses in Python and Java programming. There is also all-day robotics pavilion, maker demos, and getting started with drones, and a tour of the Sarnoff Museum of Technology. For more information, visit the website tcf-nj.org. Hope to see you there. For those who are interested in taking public transportation from New York Penn Station to the College of New Jersey, you take the New Jersey Transit from New York Penn Station to Hamilton, New Jersey, and the trains run every half hour. The ride is about 79 minutes. At Hamilton, you take the New Jersey Transit Bus number 601 to the College of New Jersey, and the cost is about $2, and it will take about 11 minutes. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Tri-State region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, March the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on cutting the cord. You know what that is? Things to consider before firing your cable company. Thursday, March the 28th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, April the 2nd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they have a new location, Danbury Hackerspace, located at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on What is an Operating System? Thursday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on April the 5th at 8 p.m., Friday, and they meet at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. King's Bite Computer Club has a meeting on Tuesday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. They meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. Computer Learning Center of Ewing has a presentation on Apple Seeds and Apple Devices, Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 2 p.m. at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, and the location is 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has their general meeting on Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and bring a photo ID with you as is required to enter the school building. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has their meeting on Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus out in Old Westbury, New York. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and podcasts are available from all major pod hosting sites, as well as on our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.